You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his best-selling book, Sapiens, Yuval Noah Harari explained how humans came to dominate our planet. And now his new book, Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, asks the question, what next? Homo sapiens have managed to transcend superstition, embrace science, and conquer the elements most threatening to our survival, so now we can pursue other goals. But what will those be, and how will their realization change our place on Earth in both anticipated and unanticipated ways? His book is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased it has brought Yuval Noah Harari to our show today. Hello.
Hello, it's good to be here again.
You say that the same three problems occupied humanity for thousands of years. What were they?
Above all, famine, plague, and war. It doesn't matter if you live in ancient Israel or in the Roman Empire or in medieval China. Famine, plague, and war were always the worst enemies of human society.
And they're still out there. Have we tamed that at least to some degree?
Yes, certainly. We did not eliminate them completely. I come from Israel, so I know perfectly well there is still violence in the world. But we have transformed them from uncontrollable forces of nature into manageable challenges. When there was an outbreak of plague, let's say in the Middle Ages, nobody really knew what to do about it except to flock to the synagogues and to the churches and to the mosques and pray to God, please do something. In the modern world, when we had the outbreak of Ebola in 2014, in the first phases of the Ebola epidemic, people were afraid that this will turn out to be like the new Black Death. But because of human responses, not because of divine miracles, because of human responses, the epidemic was stopped. And it did kill 10,000 people, which was a terrible tragedy, but a completely different story from the Black Death, which killed a third of the human population.
According to the UN, just recently, up to 50 million people in Africa have been faced with a famine crisis across the continent that was triggered by El Nino. Mm-hmm. And some believe that El Nino is largely a result of human activity. So are we conquering these problems in one way and then creating new problems along the way?
In a way, yes. I mean, we are now the source of our greatest anxieties and threats and dangers. If you think about famine, so in a way, there is no longer any natural famine in the world. Natural famine in the sense of famine caused by natural causes, for example, like drought or flood. In the past, natural famine was the greatest enemy of humankind. Today, the only famine remaining on the planet is political famine. Political famine is famine caused by political choices that people make. If people today die from starvation in Syria or North Korea or South Sudan, this is not because of natural causes. It is only because some government wants them to die.
And is that a recent development? When I think of the Great Leap Forward, mm-hmm. In China under Mao, there are a number of reasons given for that famine. One of them is political, others are that there were droughts and all sorts of other things were happening.
No, there is also some natural element. Like if you look at North Korea in the 1990s, so you had floods. And the flood certainly had something to do with the mass starvation in North Korea. But given the human abilities in the 1990s of food production and transportation, there was absolutely no problem of bringing enough food to North Korea to save these people. Not enough food was brought and distributed because of political decisions. Today in the world, actually more people die from obesity, from eating too much, than from eating too little. And we have the technology, we have the wealth, we have the knowledge to make sure that nobody starves to death. It's no longer the Middle Ages when even with the best of intentions and the best political decisions, humans starved en masse because we just didn't have the capacity to produce and transport food efficiently enough.
So McDonald's is as much of a problem as ISIS?
In terms of human lives, human health, it's a much bigger problem. I mean, many more people die today around the world from eating too much hamburgers and pizzas than from being blown up by terrorists.
Well, you mentioned earlier that we are better at dealing with at epidemics. Black death probably wouldn't have claimed as many lives, but we still see so many things. We have SARS, we have HIV, AIDS, we have Ebola. So we haven't eliminated these things for the future.
No, I'm not saying that we completely eliminated them. That's certainly not true. But they are now manageable challenges. If you look at AIDS, probably the worst disaster, the worst medical disaster of the last few decades, the slowness of the response to AIDS was for political, not for scientific reasons. And the AIDS epidemic in Africa also was fueled to a large extent by political incompetence, not by lack of the knowledge necessary to stop and roll back the epidemic. So it's still an immense challenge. But in contrast with the Black Death, this is a challenge that humans can rise to. And if we don't do it, it's because of our incompetence and not because, well, this is how things are happening in this world.
You mentioned war, that there are still conflicts, but they're different because we don't imagine a situation like Hitler suddenly trying to take over half the world.
War is now different in several respects. First of all, this is the most peaceful era in history.
Despite what we've seen in ISIS, Congo, Yemen,
yes.
I can go on.
I'm talking statistically, of course. I mean, when you say that there is less violence, it doesn't mean that there is no violence. Statistically, today, more people commit suicide than are killed by war. In most of the world, war and peace have been transformed. For most of history, peace was just the temporary absence of war. Let's say in 1913, you had peace between Germany and France, but everybody knew that within a year, there might be a war. In the Middle Ages, if you had a peace between the King of France and the King of England, it was a temporary situation and very fragile. Today, in most of the world, not all the world, but most of the world, peace have gained a new meaning. Peace is no longer the temporary absence of war, it's the unthinkability of war. I mean, nobody really takes seriously the possibility that there would be a war between France and Germany next year, or Brazil and Argentina.
So why do we keep on developing more and more sophisticated and deadly weapons?
There are still dangers out there, and looking at the broad perspective, we spent far less on armament than any previous time in history. In the Middle Ages, the average king spent 70-80% of his budget on war and soldiers and fortresses and so forth. Today in Western Europe, it's about 2-3%. Even in Israel, where I come from, which spends more on security than probably any other country in the world, maybe except North Korea, in Israel, more money is spent on health, education, and welfare than on security. So we spend far less on preparing for war than on other causes.
My guest is Yuval Noah Harari. His latest book, Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. You say that history abhors a vacuum. What will it take? What will take the place of famine, plague, and war?
At the top of the human agenda. I think the big project of humankind in the 21st century is basically to upgrade ourselves into gods. And I mean this completely seriously, and not as a metaphor. We are trying to gain abilities that traditionally were considered to be divine abilities. In particular, the ability to engineer and manufacture life. If you open the Bible, the first thing God does, and the thing that characterizes God, is his ability to create animals and plants and humans according to his wishes. Now we, with bioengineering and machine learning and so forth, we are learning to engineer and create life. And I think that the main products of the 21st century economy will not be weapons and vehicles and textiles. They will be bodies and brains and minds. And we are in the business of replacing natural selection with intelligent design as the chief motor of the evolution of life.
But aren't we going through a period of mass extinction? More species have died out during my lifetime than throughout the rest of the, through a number of millennia.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't want to say the whole history of the world because we had the dinosaurs and all of that.
The ability to create goes hand in hand with the ability to destroy. And we are now destroying life on a divine level. Just like, you know, in the Bible, God destroys life with the flood. So now we are destroying life on Earth with this human flood. And it goes hand in hand. Yes, the future of life increasingly depends on the wishes and decisions of Homo sapiens.
And there's been a lot of talk recently of being able to extend human life into the hundreds, although I'm not so sure many of us would welcome that.
I mean, it's now very, at least in places like Silicon Valley, equality is out, but immortality is very much in. Everybody is excited by this idea that maybe we can extend human life indefinitely. Certainly, we have a new vision of death. If death was traditionally thought to be kind of a metaphysical phenomenon, the preserve of priests and shamans and rabbis, now the engineers are taking over. We increasingly see death as a technical problem that could be solved by engineers.
The physicist Max Planck said that science advances one funeral at a time. Isn't that because the old ideas die before the new ones become accepted and they die out with the generation that clung to them?
Yes. I mean, if we extend human life considerably, at least of the rich people who could afford it, there could be all kinds of unforeseen consequences. Just think, would you like to have Putin stick around for another 90 years? If we can extend human life to 150. Actually, if we could extend human life to 150, Stalin would still be alive today, ruling in Moscow maybe. So there is a downside to extending human life beyond, say, a certain point.
Why can't we just put our energies into rehabilitating the planet and dealing with climate change in a way that might actually be constructive?
I would think this may be a better aim, at least for now, than trying to achieve immortality. But looking at free market dynamics and what's happening around the world, I don't think this is going to happen. I think the elite is far more interested in extending its life than in saving the planet from an ecological disaster.
We are talking about Yuval Noah Harari's latest book, Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, now available in a paperback edition from Harper, which is an imprint of Harper Collins Publishers. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Yuval Noah Harari, whose latest book is Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, follow-up to his bestseller Sapiens. It is published by Harper. This was originally published in Hebrew.
Yes.
And did you do your own translation?
Actually, it's more of rewriting than translating. Yes, I did it myself, but I changed many of the examples. I had a lot of feedback about the Hebrew edition, which I incorporated into the English edition. So it's really kind of a new book.
That's an advantage of being able to do it this way, because if you publish a first edition and people and you get feedback, you can't change the second edition all that much.
Yeah, I mean, that's the advantages of publishing in Hebrew, which very few people read. And then you can do the real thing in English.
But you also, I'm assuming, you know that the references are different in the English-speaking world.
Yes. So, again, as I said, I changed many of the examples. Far fewer examples from Israeli history, more example from Chinese or American history.
You say that another large project on the human agenda will be finding the key to happiness. Isn't happiness an ephemeral notion?
It's a problematic notion. I mean, there are many different definitions, but I think it's a very urgent project because humans have been gaining more and more power over thousands of years, and we are very good in gaining power. We don't seem to know how to translate all that power into happiness.
Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Declaration of Independence, states that all men have a right to the pursuit of happiness, but it's a right to the pursuit of happiness.
Yes, and again, the question is, how do you pursue happiness? Today in the U.S., the main road of the pursuit of happiness is through consumption, consumerism. And that's very dangerous, because if the rest of the world follows the U.S. in that pursuit of happiness, then this is really the end of the ecological system. If you give an American standard of living to every Chinese and Indian and African, the planet cannot hold it.
We seeing that happening to some degree? For example, more consumption of meat throughout the planet than in the past?
And that's exactly what is causing this ecological catastrophe that we are facing. And if we don't find a better way to make people satisfied and happy, then we are in for a very difficult time. This is why I think the question of happiness is not just, you know, some kind of luxury for philosophers. It's really an urgent economic and political question. Because if the only way, or if the main way to be to pursue happiness is a consumerist way, then we are in really difficult situation.
How are our experiences of happiness limited now? Aren't some of those limitations chemical or biological, based on survival instincts that we've been cultivating for thousands of years?
At a very deep level, I think the basic problem is that happiness depends on expectations, not on your objective condition. And as your condition improves, your expectations increase. So no matter how much we gain and achieve, people are not becoming more satisfied. They just want more. And at an even deeper level, I mean, deep in the mind, the basic reaction of the human mind to achievement is not satisfaction. It's craving for more. Like, I write a bestseller and it reaches number 5 in the bestseller list. I want to be number 1 and I want to write another one. It's very difficult to make people satisfied.
But talking about expectation, you can't really predict what's going to come. 50 years ago, I don't know if anybody would have thought that we would have cell phones, these teeny little cell phones, and that anything that is typical of our lives today would be present. They were predicting other kinds of things, like we'd be flying around jet propelled cars. And can history be predicted? Can we predict the future?
No, I mean, we can't predict the future, and it's becoming more difficult than ever before. In the past, at least you could predict the basic structure of human society. So you lived in the Middle Ages, you didn't know what the political situation will be in 50 years, but you did know that most people will still be peasants, or that men will still dominate women, and that life expectancy will still be around 40. But when we look 40, 50 years to the future, nobody has any idea what the job market would look like in 40 years. Nobody knows what gender relations will be in 40 years. Nobody knows what the human body would be like in 40 years, which means that we don't even know what to teach children at school, because we don't know what kind of world they will inhabit. I mean, most of what they learn today will probably be irrelevant by the time they are 40, but we just don't know what to teach them instead.
Well, for a while, many people felt that the theories of Marx were scientific. Communism was scientific.
Mm-hmm.
But now, of course, we no longer believe that. How good was Marx at predicting the future? How good was he as a historian?
For his time, he was remarkably good, and he changed the way we understand history and society. Even the most ardent opponents of Marxism have adopted not his political platform, but his understanding of history. We now understand history to be controlled by economic and technological forces, by class struggles, things that, you know, you wrote history in the 18th century before Marx, so everything was just diplomacy and battles and kings and queens. Hardly anybody spoke about economic forces or class struggles.
But so he writes this, and then to some degree his theory leads to changes, whether we could have predicted them or not.
Yeah, I mean, our interpretation of history is influences history. In many situations in life, your predictions don't influence the situation. They are an external force. But in history, your predictions about history are themselves a historical factor. If you predict war, it increases the chances that war will actually happen. Because once people think, oh, war is coming, they start spending more on military preparation. They become more afraid of their neighbors. And then there is an arms race which leads to war. So just, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
My guest is Yuval Noah Harari, whose latest book is Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You trace the way humans came to dominate other animals. How many wolves live in Germany today?
As far as I remember, about 100.
But there are a lot of dogs.
I think 5 million dogs. Mm-hmm.
And that's because dogs were evolved to please people.
Dogs are part of human society, and they flourished alongside as members of human society in a way that wolves just didn't.
So we have influenced which animals survive and which ones don't survive.
Yeah, we are now the gods of planet Earth. We decide who lives and who dies, at least in the mammal kingdom. With bacteria, it's much more difficult. But with the big animals, they're completely under our control.
And you say that domesticated farm animals, as they're raised now, contradict the most basic principles of natural selection.
Not necessarily contradict, but I would say that domestic farm animals today are probably the most miserable animals that ever existed. We treat them as if they are just machines for producing meat and milk and eggs, and we ignore the fact, the scientific fact, that they have minds, they have emotions and sensations, they can feel pain and fear and love. I mean, the entire milk industry is built on breaking the bond between mother and infant. A cow doesn't produce milk for human consumers. The only reason a cow produces milk is because you get it pregnant and she gives birth to a calf, and then she produces milk to feed the calf, but then you take away the calf and slaughter it and eat it, and you milk the cow. And this causes a lot of agony for both the cow and the calf to be separated. And the entire milk industry is built on that, on breaking the bond between the mother and the infant.
You approach the question of whether animals are innately inferior to men by analyzing them as algorithms. What do you mean by that? How do algorithms apply?
Oh, that's quite a complicated issue, but I would say that.
Well, we have about 8 more minutes.
So let's say how to approach this. I mean, there are two main arguments people use to justify our treatment of animals. The first argument is that animals don't have emotions. Only humans have emotions. We shouldn't care about them. And this is, you know, this is nonsense. According to modern science, emotions are not some, metaphysical quality that God gave only Homo sapiens in order to read poetry and to write music. Emotions are kind of biochemical algorithms shaped by natural selection in order to make decisions. This is how all mammals make decisions, based on emotions. This is where the connection with algorithm comes. So it's not something unique to humans.
Hmm.
Fear and love are the way that we make decisions in our lives, what to run away from, what to come close to. And it's the same with cows. They are fearful, and they can experience such emotions just like human beings.
But the Bible tells us we are superior to the other animals. To some degree, doesn't this also apply the way we deal with other people? For example, colonialism is based on the idea that some people are superior to others.
Exactly. Now, the other argument that is being used regarding superiority is, okay, other animals have emotions, but they say we are more intelligent than all the other animals. And because we are more intelligent, we can do to them anything we like. And I think that's a very dangerous argument in the 21st century, because soon enough, Homo sapiens may no longer be the most intelligent entity on Earth. And if you think that a higher intelligence can do anything it likes, to a lower intelligence, then Homo sapiens may be in deep trouble within a few decades when there will be more intelligent entities out there than we are.
You also argue that science can undermine the foundations of the liberal order. Does science undermine belief in individualism?
Basically, yes. I mean, the idea of the individual, the very word individual, it means indivisible, something that cannot be divided. It's the idea that I have a single authentic self, which is the true I, and whenever I face some important decision in life, I need to discover my authentic self and listen to this inner voice. And this may have sounded plausible in the 18th century, but it runs completely counter to 21st century science. The life sciences tell us there is no such thing as an authentic self. Human beings, like other animals, are composed of many biochemical systems. And when you look inside, you can see the amazing complexity of these systems, but you never find a single self that that is your true identity, that is your true entity. Now, it should be said that we are very, very far from understanding the mysteries of the mind and consciousness. It's probably the greatest riddle science still faces in the 21st century. We've made immense progress in understanding the brain, but very little progress in understanding the mind, partly because the only mind we can observe directly is our own mind. There is no other mind in the universe that I can actually observe except my own.
We're all solipsistic on some level.
We certainly believe that other minds exist.
I believe everybody's a figment of my imagination.
I can look at your brain using an fMRI scanner and I can ask you how do you feel, but I can't access directly your feelings and emotions and thoughts.
You predict that three practical developments in the 21st century may undermine the value of the individual. Is there going to be a new elite?
We already see the formation of a new elite based on the new technologies of the 21st century.
But we're relying on computers to do all sorts of things that we used to do ourselves. And in some cases, the computers are superior to humans.
Yes, I think that what we are already seeing, and we see more and more in the future, is a shift in authority from humans to algorithms. More and more decisions about our life, whether as individuals or as a society, will be taken by algorithms and not by human beings, because they are the only ones that can make sense of the immense amount of data that we are collecting and accumulating about everything. I mean, even today, if you apply to the bank and ask for a loan, chances are that your application goes to an algorithm, not a human being, and it's the algorithm that decides whether to give you a loan or not. And if it says no, and you ask the bank why not, the bank says, we don't know, the algorithm said no.
You're calling this dataism.
Yes, it's the belief that data is the source and data processing is the supreme source of authority. If in the Middle Ages, authority came from the clouds, from God above the clouds, and then in the modern age, humanism brought down authority from the clouds to humans, now authority is shifting back to the clouds, to the Google cloud, to the Microsoft cloud. This is the new source of authority.
Now, this book is filled with ideas that we can't even address because we don't have enough time, but I found them all fascinating. But I was wondering if it was your intention to have this book serve the same purpose as The Visit of the Spirit of Christmas Yet to Come in A Christmas Carol. Do you mean it as a warning?
I think so, yes. It's not a book of prophecies. Nobody can predict the future. It covers many different and contradictory possibilities. And the whole idea is that we can still do something about it. What's the point of writing prophecies about things you cannot change? I think technology is not deterministic. It's never deterministic. It gives us options. If you look at the 20th century, so with the new technologies of the 20th century, like trains and electricity and radio, you could create communist dictatorships, or you could create liberal democracies. The trains and the radio did not tell you what to do with them. It's the same with artificial intelligence and bioengineering in the 21st century. We still have quite a lot of choice what to do with them.
Although Scrooge asked in that in A Christmas Carol, why show me this if I'm past all hope?
We are not past all hope. I mean, just to give a simple example, we talked about animals and about bioengineering. So we can use bioengineering to engineer cows that produce more milk and more meat more efficiently in complete disregard of what it means to the cow. Or we could use bioengineering to start producing what is known as cultured meat, meat that is grown from cells. You don't need a cow. If you want a steak, you don't need a cow. You just grow the steak. This is not science fiction. The first hamburger produced from cells has already been cooked and eaten 1 or 2 years ago. And if this is where we want to go, so if we invest time and energy and money in that, we can go in that direction, which will be much better for the animals and probably much better for the ecology as well.
Did the person who ate that hamburger think it tasted good?
I'm not sure. It wasn't me, so I don't know.
Yuval Noah Harari, his latest book, Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, available from Harper. It's been a pleasure having you back on our show.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to be here.